From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The world's changing, and what are things we can do to transform our business and engage our fans globally in different ways?
People are using their name and likeness to create more opportunities, more stakes in companies.
In order to turn the organization around, we had to turn it around not only just on the baseball operations side, but on the business operations side.
Football and any other sport is very difficult, but I like to broaden my horizons and be able to expand.
Sports need to be consumed live, and that's a big competitive advantage for intellectual property holders of sports content in the media landscape.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, Ken, this is just a thrill to talk to you. First of all, congratulations on this film. I was telling you just before we started recording, I finished watching it. It's haunting in a lot of ways, unbelievably relevant. And, you know, what's so amazing about your work is you take your time on this. And so clearly you couldn't have anticipated how relevant and timely it is. And so I have to ask you, why Ali? Why now?
Well, first of all, there's no now. I mean, we started this 6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of accident of doing that. I'm thrilled that you like it. Please let me take this time to tell you that this film is co-directed by Sarah Burns and David McMahon and myself, and Sarah and David wrote the script, and we three plus Stephanie Jenkins are the producer, and there's a handful of editors and assistant editors and co-producers that have found the footage and found the still photographs. By taking time, we can do a deep dive. By doing a deep dive, we can get undertow and nuance and contradiction and allow a much more fuller portrait than the kind of baggage that we carry. You know, I had my own Muhammad Ali baggage, and I tell you, it's on some carousel in some other city, and it's been gone for years and years, I'm thrilled to say. And what you're left with is this incredibly moving story of one of the great Americans of all time. Forget about adding sports to it. We know he's the greatest boxer of the greatest athlete of the 20th century, or so says most of the media. But he's one of the great Americans, and he shows it again and again in not just his successes, but also in his failures. Not just in his great attributes, but also in the mistakes that he makes. And that's, of course, true of all of us. But when it's somebody writ large as Muhammad Ali, you realize, you know, there are a lot of great documentaries about him that have already been made, often about a particular fight, sometimes about a couple of years, his battle with the United States over induction into the armed forces. But we were interested in the whole of him, from his birth and childhood in Jim Crow segregated Louisville, Kentucky, to his death by Parkinson's, but a few years ago, 5 years ago, in a suburb of Phoenix, Arizona. So in that span, he intersects with all the major themes of the last half of the 20th century, the role of sports, the nature of the black athlete, faith, religion, politics, war, and of course, race, not to mention the personal dimensions of family and faithfulness and things like that. And we find in every film that when we wake up after attending, and I swear to you, we attend most assiduously for years to getting the story right, we wake up and realize it's talking about everything we're talking about today. And that's true of Muhammad Ali. It was true of the Vietnam War film. It was true of the Civil War. It's true of any film we've done. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Right.
And we don't have to go looking for those rhymes. It doesn't matter when we start the film. Whatever you do in the history, if you do it well, whether it's 25 years ago, 50 years ago, 250 years ago, we're just finishing a film on Benjamin Franklin, it rhymes.
It's so true. And yet I will say that I feel like I have heard Ali's name more in the past 2 to 3 years, maybe the last 18 months, than I had for the previous few. And we'll go back a ways, but I do want to talk about that immediate cultural relevance, the echoes yes. that he has, whether it's with LeBron James, whether it's with Colin Kaepernick. He is being called out and called upon. His legacy is being called upon. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a simple couple of words. One is freedom. He insisted on being free all his life. That's a big American theme. But for a black person doing that, we'd have to admit, I don't think there's anybody within the sound of my voice who wouldn't admit that that's, even in America, a fairly complicated proposition. And there are going to be obstacles thrown up to his attempt to be free on his own terms. The other word is courageous. He does some courageous stands. He takes a stand in favor of his faith and against the war in Vietnam, and he pays for it dearly. He's sentenced to 5 years in prison. He loses 3.5 years of his life. It's a very complicated, dramatic story. So when we think about the modern athlete today, you can say maybe John Carlos and Tommy Smith in the Mexico City Olympics, you know, they really lost everything. Kurt Flood standing up against the reserve clause, a black man trying to get rid of the old plantation system in baseball, gone. It would take two guys, Messerschmidt and McNally, two white guys to begin the process that would undo that pernicious thing, the reserve clause. And then there's Colin Kaepernick. They paid the price. So when we hear people talking, whether the GOATs in their particular sport or not, it's still not on the same term of Muhammad Ali, who said he'd face a firing squad. He'd say, I'd face a machine gun tomorrow rather than abandon my faith. And that kind of courage, that kind of strength is impossible to deny. And so we find him as a source of inspiration for lots of people today. Towards the end of the film, you see a young black woman on the Brooklyn Bridge protesting. We've made sure you don't really read what the protest is, and she's wearing a black T-shirt with the simple white letters, Muhammad Ali. That was all she needed to say. That was all she needed to sort of plant her foot and say, no, right now. And I find that incredibly inspiring. And having delved with Sarah and Dave and our team for years and years trying to get inside this guy, you're just amazed at what a powerful, ebullient, beautiful human being he was, even with all the flaws that were, as you saw, unafraid to detail.
Well, and it's fascinating too, Ken, to look at this film and recall, or in many people's cases, learn how controversial he was
yes.
and how disliked he was. And exactly. that's not a strong enough word.
No, especially divisive, when hated.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I was talking with my 18-year-old about this, and I was telling him a little bit about the film and about the complicated, to say the least, relationship that America and the world had with him. And he that was a surprise to him. But because yeah. in the shorthand, Muhammad Ali today is heroic, but you remind us in this film, he was not viewed no. in that way. Tell me more about that.
Well, he dies the most beloved person on his planet, which is, you know, almost impossible for anyone else to say in the history of humankind. Only a handful of people might fit into that. The writer David Remnick says he's at the end of his life almost revered like a Buddha, but people forget how divisive he was. So just remember, he comes out of the Rome Olympics with a gold medal. He's smiling. He's voluble. He knows how to talk to a camera and a microphone, and people love him. And then he starts bragging, and he starts saying how beautiful he is, and he does the things that athletes are sort of not supposed to do, and particularly black athletes are not supposed to do. And so there's a kind of step up, and people talk about before the first Liston fight, let's shut him up, let's put him in his place, and you can hear the echoes of what that's about. And then he joins, after he defeats Liston, and he publicly joins the Nation of Islam, a separatist religious cult. You can't even call it a branch of Islam. It's got its own problems, which we detail. And then it's already been labeled by mainstream media as a hate group. And there are aspects of it that are corrupt and hate-filled. And they are also the murderers of Malcolm X, one of their own, whom they expelled. And then, you know, he refuses the draft. And that puts him at odds with a majority of American citizens, black as well as white, who are essentially supporting the war, at least initially, and he won't budge. He knows he could get a cushy job. He knows he'd be doing USO shows and making appearances and mugging with GIs. He's not going to do that. And it is stunning, and it brings out the worst, and it brings out the best. He becomes a hero on college campuses, a hero to a different new kind of black manhood, black masculinity that maybe a generation before Jackie Robinson embodied. Now he embodies, Jim Brown embodies. It's a wonderfully complicated story, and then he works his way back. You know, he's exonerated by the Supreme Court. He loses to Joe Frazier, but in the words of the sports writer Robert Lipsyk, he wins America because he's trying desperately to get back in the game, which he knows he's losing on points, and he gets floored by Frazier in the last round, gets up, is willing to fight. He takes his defeat in a manly way, even though the lead up to the fight is he's just irresponsible in his treatment of Joe Frazier, calling him things that only a white racist would call another black man. And this is one black man to another. He's made Joe Frazier the hero of white America, and he's the hero, he believes, of black America. It's not his finest moment, but he's amazing at the end, and begin people by this time are beginning to realize, you know, he may have been right on Vietnam.
Right.
And then he works his way, and when he wins back the championship for the first time, it's one of the most magnificent moments in the history of sports of all time. You cannot believe that this underdog did what he did, older, out of shape, and against this, you know, formidable opponent, George Foreman. It's just one of the great stories that you can't do. And we've embedded as our secret weapon in the film is Michael Bent, the former heavyweight champion, who we put inside every one of the important fights that we treat to tell those of us who are not boxing fans and those who may even be repelled by the sport, just stick around. Here's some strategy. Here's some tactics. But I'd rather tell you about the psychology. I'd rather tell you about the hearts. I'd rather tell you about the will and the passion and what's going on in a kind of interpersonal subtext here. And it makes the fights come alive. And if you add the sports writers who grew up with him, like Sam Kindred and Jerry Eisenberg and Robert Lipsyk, you have the scholars like Sherman Jackson and Gerald Early and Todd Boyd, and the writers Walter Mosley and David Remnick of The New Yorker, and you've got his biographer Jonathan Eig, and you've got his brother, and you've got two of his four wives and two of his daughters. All of a sudden, you're getting Don King and Bob Arum, two of his promoters.
Right.
You're beginning to understand. And then Larry Holmes himself makes an important appearance in the film. And you begin to understand a little bit more who he was from all these different perspectives, not just the perspective that most of us understand conventionally.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the fights, because it's also a reminder of what cultural touchstones those fights were,
yeah.
How everyone literally in the world was focused on them. You know, a billion people reportedly, you know, view one of the fights. Hey, tell me about that cultural relevance of those bouts.
Well, you know, the heavyweight champion of the world was always a big deal, particularly at the end of the 19th and earliest 20th century, which made Jack Johnson so terrifying, because it was presumed that the white person was the champion, and white people had been the champion. And as he began to come up and it looked like he had talent, nobody would fight him. And then somebody paid this guy named Tommy Burns, no relation, a chance to fight him in Australia. And Jack Johnson wins. And then every white hope and great white hope they sent after him are defeated. And when they can't beat him in the ring, they go after him in court, a kind of mirror of Muhammad Ali's story. So it meant something who that championship was. But by the 60s, it had lost its luster. The mob had been too much involved for, you know, a couple of decades. Liston was mobbed up. It just didn't seem like anything. And then along comes this guy, this uber American, you know, with all of the talents of a promoter and huckster like a P.T. Barnum, all of the skill of the greatest athlete of all time, and all of the contentious politics and religious beliefs that would set some people's, you know, teeth on edge. And he does it. And so suddenly we care about it. I'm caring about fights. I'm a baseball fan. I like conventional American sports like football and basketball, and particularly baseball. And And he's riveting. I remember being in film class in, and somebody had gotten some pirated film of the Foreman fight in Kinshasa, Zaire, like within a month or so of the fight. No commercials, no commentary, just silent footage of, and we would watch it over and over again. I couldn't believe I was cheering then, and I'm cheering now at something that is an incredibly brutal sport. It's called the Sweet Science, but it's a brutal sport. And let's remember, the lead up to the first Frazier fight, it was called the fight of the century. It's what they also said, the Jack Johnson fight on July 4th, 1910 against Jim Jeffries, who'd been brought out of retirement to put Jack Johnson in his place, and it didn't work out so well for Jim Jeffries. That was the fight of the century. But I'd argue that maybe that first Frazier fight really was. And the most of the black world was for Ali, and most of the white world was for Frazier. That is, of course, not completely true. The odds makers, it gave it a little edge to Frazier because he'd been or not in exile. The men were each paid, as Jonathan Eig, Ali's biographer, said, as much as Henry Aaron each, as much as Henry Aaron made in his entire professional baseball career for one night's work.
Wow.
So you begin to understand the huge business of it, the closed circuit stuff. It's worldwide, as you say. We're talking hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people tuning in to things like this, who are listening. And it becomes these cultural touchstones in which we define ourselves in the 70s by lots of different metrics. The end of Vietnam, we're now thinking about it a lot today because the Chinook helicopters are taking off from Kabul, but also as they did from Saigon. We think about it musically, you know, Stevie Wonder or this or that or whoever it might be. And we also think about it about these central fights, the first Frazier fight, the second Frazier fight, the Rumble in the Jungle, the Thrill in Manila, the third Frazier fight. This is how we define that decade or so. It's pretty amazing, and you know where you were and what you were thinking and who you were for. And somehow, at the end of it, the punishment that he took is going to precipitate the debilitating neurological disease he'll get. But in the end, he transcends all of it. We're 25 years this summer from his lighting of the torch with that shaky hand,
right.
And we loved him for it. So much of the problems that many people had, if they hadn't disappeared already, began to melt away. And I assume there are a few Ali haters still out there, but he died the most beloved person on his planet. Not bad. Not bad.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Well, and it's so interesting because Walter Mosley had, you listed some of the folks that you interviewed for this, and that cultural touchstone really does come through, that all of these people, and you talk about, some of the really well-known writers, whether it's Plimpton or Gay Talese or Hunter S. Thompson, Norman Mailer, of course, they're covering these fights. But Walter Mosley says in 1974, and keep me honest here, Muhammad Ali is the most important man in the world. And,
yes.
And that does not seem like hyperbole.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. He's Walter's already described him as dangerous, because he's planting ideas in his young preteen and teenage brain. And then later on, he says, and when someone asked him about Vietnam, he goes, I don't know why I have to go over there. And he realized afterwards, that wasn't his original thought. That was Muhammad Ali's thought that had been implanted. The sign of a good leader is that you accept that logic or that action or that courage on your own, and you intuit the external influence. And so, by the time he wins in Kinshasa, in the Rumble in the Jungle, we tend to think of history as a political thing. We forget how celebrity driven we are anyway at any time. But there's nobody more important in the world at that point than Muhammad Ali. He's a hero to a lot of people. to Black Americans, but also to Sub-Saharan and Saharan Africa, to the rest of the Muslim world in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, and people around the world who felt like they hadn't gotten a fair shake. And here was this guy who came from that side of the tracks, who was defiant. And he himself, in the very beginning of the film, he just states it right out, quote, you know, I'm one who got into your face, in your white airplanes, on your white TV, on your satellite, but I stayed true to my people. I retained the freedom, but I represented where I came from. And that's a really important thing for him, and it was a really important message for other people to hear. All the while, we were hearing something else. We were hearing, oh, he's too vain, or oh, he's too this, or he's too contentious, or he's being too political, shut up and dribble. You know, that kind of sentimentality about sports figures that speak out, or ridiculousness, not sentimentality. And so he's complicated, but his message for most of the people in the world was pretty direct. Look at me. I'm beautiful. I'm as pretty as a girl. And he's this handsome, chiseled specimen. And he is, but he's also empowering people. If he can say that, I can say that too. And think of how powerful a tool that is in a world that pretends to be, you know, interested in democracy and equality and has the hardest time delivering on it, whether it's socially or economically, with housing or jobs or salary or anything like that, to have somebody who was not just doing it for himself. Right. Jeff Johnson was just doing it for himself. He was going to do whatever he wanted to do. He was going to sleep with whoever he was going to sleep. He was going to marry whomever he wanted to, white or black, and did. But Muhammad Ali had a larger purpose. And there's a wonderful shot in the first episode, and when he's training in the Fifth Street Gym when the Beatles invasion happens, and there's John Paul, George, and Ringo, and there's a fake shot, and he's punching Lennon, and Lennon is about to topple like a domino, and McCartney and Harrison and Starr in sequence. And you realize, man, there are five people who understood in the last half of the 20th century what it was really about. Best written by, I think, by Paul McCartney, who said, the love you take is equal to the love you make. And how interesting that in a brutal sport like boxing, the guy who could be the avatar, the embodiment of that message of love, would be Muhammad Ali, a boxer in the roughest sport there is.
Well, and the economics of it, as you allude to, become incredible. I believe you point out in the film that he earns $50 million, which is equal to every heavyweight champion that came before him.
In total.
In total.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how he changed the dynamics. I mean, we look to baseball and to football for these sort of astronomical salaries, and now, of course, they do draft dwarf even Muhammad Ali's. But what we have to understand is that he was the first. He was this pioneer. And it's so interesting that when he comes back from the Rome Olympics, you know, he's got these white sponsors, these 11 white businessmen in Louisville who protect him from the mob, right? Who give him a contract. They went to Hollywood to study the contract for Shirley Temple, and they pay all his expenses. They put him on a salary. They give him a huge portion of his gate, and they're just there to protect him. And they do for a while, and it works wonders, but it's such an incredible anomaly to be thinking about Muhammad Ali and seeing these white businessmen, but they also got him. They understood early on that this was a local boy who made good and that he was a good man at heart. And even when reporters are pushing them about, isn't the Nation of Islam a hate group? They said, well, if it is a hate group, then he's not really in it because he doesn't have a bone of hatred in his body.
Right. And they see he's ultimately a good investment in many ways.
He is a good investment. He is a classic American investment. There's been nobody better in the history of boxing, period, full stop. And, you know, Time and Newsweek and Sports Illustrated all voted him the athlete of the 20th century. And I don't think I'd get much argument even on a bar stool anywhere by suggesting that he might be just the greatest athlete of all times. And given what he went through, this kind of epic story, there's no battle in Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter that comes close to the third Frasier fight. I invite you to go back and look at that and say, you know, no number of millions of orcs or you know, whatever they are in Harry Potter can really hold a candle to these two men, as Jerry Eisenberg says, sort of fighting on an ice floe by themselves, and the closest thing to death on the set.
Yeah, no, I was rewatching that, and just again, it's one of the things that's most compelling about the film is you do go deep into these fights. You know, they ultimately turn into these sort of set pieces throughout, yes, where you really just get this sense both of the importance and obviously, as you alluded to, the brutality of the sport. From a cultural relevance perspective, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You know, he sort of puts boxing, you know, back. And then we see in the post-Ali time frame, boxing sort of wane again. And I wonder, you know, you again, echoes to now, you think about the UFC and Conor McGregor and all of these, you know, sort of larger than life. Where does boxing sort of ebb and flow historically? Or what did you learn about it as you went through this project?
I know that boxing had a much greater role, as I was saying, at the end of the 19th and the early 20th century in this great dramatic upheaval when Jack Johnson got it. And then it kind of, you know, Joe Louis meant a great deal to the black community, but that's a relatively small percentage of the population, and a small population of within that population likes boxing, but he's a source of pride. Jackie Robinson, of course. But what Muhammad Ali did is bring who the heavyweight champion was back to the fore.
Right.
And inevitably, as he leaves the game, as he's no longer a viable, possible thing, it ebbs again. And no amount of Conor McGregor or these, you know, manipulations of the sport are going to bring it back. You need somebody of the caliber of a Muhammad Ali. And I just don't see that coming. He is so sui generis. I mean, it's like saying, you know, gee, you know what baseball really needs is Babe Ruth.
Right.
Good luck on that.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to happen. What we really need is to have another, you know, Wilt Chamberlain or Bill Russell, you know, well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who we interview in this film. Good luck on that.
Right.
You know, we do have a really great crop of basketball players right now, and many of them have been, in a way, the previous generation, the Michael Jordan generation, weren't outspoken. They are outspoken, but they're not risking their Nike contracts. They're not risking their basketball contracts. They're not in danger of being running afoul of the United States government, no matter how much Senate candidates might say, shut up and dribble. So you begin to appreciate even more a stature of a man like Muhammad Ali and that courage that keeps him going. And I think a key to this is his faith. Whatever his investment with the Nation of Islam, for him it's sincere. And he grows with it just the way Malcolm X was trying to grow with it before he was assassinated. And when Elijah Muhammad, the head of the Nation of Islam, dies and his son Wallace takes over and steers it into a much more ecumenical, a much more generous, a much more mainstream, closer to what Islam is, you see Ali flowing with that naturally. And the last years of his life is just nothing really to do with the Nation of Islam in terms of the way it was when he joined it, and more to do with just one of the world's great religions trying to show people a path. And his daughter Hana, you know, speaks to this and says that her dad had said that all the great religions were like the water in rivers. They all contain the same thing.
Right.
And they're just from different names and different sources. And the object is the same. And we shouldn't kid ourselves. If you and I were born in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, we'd be Sunni Muslims,
right,
period.
Right.
Full stop.
So as we wrap up, I have to ask you about that moment in 1996 in Atlanta. I'm an Atlanta guy, so I was there in the city when that happened. I don't think anybody could have scripted it. They could have predicted what that would ultimately mean. It almost didn't happen, as you point out.
It was Dick Ebersol's idea, the head of NBC Sports. What a great idea. Ran into opposition. He overcame that opposition, swore everybody to secrecy. Muhammad Ali was against it. His friend, the photographer Howard Bingham, said, look, you know, people will love you. He didn't want to show off his infirmity. He was kind of embarrassed by it. So it was presumed that Janet Evans would light the torch, and he takes it from her at the end. He comes out, he's shaking from an uncontrollable palsy. They even had reserve. She was going to keep hers lit so that if he dropped his, she could light the torch that would go up to the large flame at the top of the stadium in Atlanta. I remember sitting on my couch here in my house, just on the other side of this yard, and weeping. Just weeping for all that I'd been through with him. I remember the Rome Olympics, my dad telling me about this guy. I remember the Liston fight. I remember all the things in between. I grew up on a college campus, so we were opposed to the Vietnam War. And so his stand was principled. So when people were hating him even more, I was loving him even more. And just to see him there and the bravery, once again, the courage it took to do that and share that with the rest of the world was transcendent. And I think it dissolved a lot of negativity for a lot of people and allowed him to, you know, he's around for a long time,
right?
Until 2016, another 21 years. But all of that is devoted to serving others. As he said, service to others is the rent you pay for your room in heaven. And we know he definitely has a big room.
Yeah, well, congratulations. What an honor to talk to you. It's an amazing film. I hope everyone watches it. I learned a lot, and it is haunting in the best possible way. Ken Burns, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. I'm so thrilled that you like it. I'll tell Sarah and Dave.
All right. Be well. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ken, that was amazing. I could talk to you all day. I really appreciate it.
That was so fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I wish it could go on. Unfortunately, you know how this is.
Oh, I know. No, you're on quite a treadmill right now.
Yeah, but you know what? I love it. There's this, you know, you love making the film, and then you love the evangelical part. Maybe it's like Ali, you know, where you just, I want to go out and remind people he isn't just the thing that you think he is. And I think the great thing we love is when people said, I never saw that photograph. I never saw that piece of footage. Oh, I didn't know that fact. And when you hear that from the biographers and the scholars, then you know you're onto something.
Right, right. Well, take good care while you're evangelizing, and hope to see you before too long. Thank you.
I look forward to our paths crossing again. Thanks so much for the thoughtfulness of your questions. I really appreciate it.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.